Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de la Comunidad Autónoma de Canarias. Pruebas de certificación de nivel avanzado C2 de inglés. Convocatoria ordinaria de 2024. Prueba de comprensión de textos orales. Esta parte consta de tres tareas. Escuchará cada grabación dos veces. Escuche y lea las instrucciones al principio de cada tarea y realícela según se indica. Solo se admitirán respuestas en tinta negra o azul. Las tareas escritas a lápiz no se calificarán. No está permitido el uso del diccionario. El uso de cualquier dispositivo electrónico queda prohibido durante toda la prueba. El móvil tendrá que permanecer apagado y guardado. Atención, no escriba en los recuadros sombreados. Son espacios reservados para la calificación de las tareas.
Task 1. Listen to 6 tips about the process of creating. Match each tip 1 to 6 to the most suitable phrase A to J. There are 3 extra phrases you do not need. Write your answers in the table provided. Tip 0 is an example. Now you have 1 minute to read the task. Example.
You are a storyteller. Go through the images you've shot once and use the star ratings that all the software packages use to start separating the pictures that work well from the ones that don't work well. Once you have the best pictures rated 4 and 5 stars, use the filter in the software package to show just those pictures. Now go through the 4 and 5 star images a second time and start the process of thinking about...
One.
You need to have a good sense of what they do, their mission, and who they serve. If you can speak with a board member and people who have worked in the field, that will likely be helpful. It will give you a better sense of not only their mission, but the people and passion behind their organization. They may have ideas for the jingle, or they may not, but something they say may inspire you. See if you can visit their headquarters or see their work in action. I recommend writing more than one jingle so they have options.
Two.
It's essential, though, that before you write, determine what you want to say and where you're coming from. Understand your own point of view, otherwise you're just annoying people. So how do you see the world? I see the glass as half full. Why can't my glass be all full? My glass sucks. You see, I made a joke, but that's my joke. You can't have it. Find a topic other people can relate to. Can you find the funny in your pathological fear of death? There's my comedy persona again.
Three.
Remember this. Only that character can say that specific line in the room. What do I mean by that? I mean that if you have 5 characters sitting around on a table in a scene and someone says, well, pass me the frickin' peas, he is saying it because he's the only person that embodies that character trait and would choose those specific words.
Four.
Finding your creative spark is all about experimenting with getting past the fear that stops you being creative. Try making something with no intention of it being high art. A doodle, a silly rhyme, a chocolate cake even. Ease yourself in gently and see if you can simply enjoy your creativity before trying to make a masterpiece. Write down all of the reasons that you can't or won't be creative.
5.
My suggestion is that you sit down with a cup of whatever you enjoy and just let your mind drift into the past. When you come across a thought that has emotional content for you, get it down. Do this for maybe 20 days, and by the time you have 20 different sections like this, you're going to, by this time, know what it is you want to say and what effect you want it to have on your audience. It's easy to turn it into a book. There are lots of different ways.
Six.
So have a song or music or some kind of character voices or video involved to keep people interested. Perform your show as much as you can. Do theater festivals like fringe festivals, or find a theater space and invite people. Or you could really perform the show anywhere. I've performed in people's houses and things like that. And just understand that your very first shows probably aren't going to be your best shows, and allow yourself to get better at it.
Listen again. Example.
You are a storyteller. Go through the images you've shot once and use the star ratings that all the software packages use to start separating the pictures that work well from the ones that don't work well. Once you have the best pictures rated 4 and 5 stars, use the filter in the software package to show just those pictures. Now go through the 4 and 5 star images a second time and start the process of thinking about...
One.
You need to have a good sense of what they do, their mission, and who they serve. If you can speak with a board member and people who have worked in the field, that will likely be helpful. It will give you a better sense of not only their mission, but the people and passion behind their organization. They may have ideas for the jingle, or they may not, but something they say may inspire you. See if you can visit their headquarters or see their work in action. I recommend writing more than one jingle so they have options.
It's essential, though, that before you write, determine what you want to say and where you're coming from. Understand your own point of view, otherwise you're just annoying people. So how do you see the world? I see the glass as half full. Why can't my glass be all full? My glass sucks. You see, I made a joke, but that's my joke. You can't have it. Find a topic other people can relate to. Can you find the funny in your pathological fear of death? There's my comedy persona again.
3.
Remember this. Only that character can say that specific line in the room. What do I mean by that? I mean that if you have 5 characters sitting around on a table in a scene and someone says, well, pass me the frickin' peas, he is saying it because he's the only person that embodies that character trait and would choose those specific words.
4.
Finding your creative spark is all about experimenting with getting past the fear that stops you being creative. Try making something with no intention of it being high art. A doodle, a silly rhyme, a chocolate cake even. Ease yourself in gently and see if you can simply enjoy your creativity before trying to make a masterpiece. Write down all of the reasons that you can't or won't be creative.
5.
My suggestion is that you sit down with a cup of whatever you enjoy and just let your mind drift into the past. When you come across a thought that has emotional content for you, get it down. Do this for maybe 20 days, and by the time you have 20 different sections like this, you're going to, by this time, know what it is you want to say and what effect you want it to have on your audience. It's easy to turn it into a book. There are lots of different ways.
6.
So have a song or music or some kind of character voices or video involved to keep people interested. perform your show as much as you can. Do theater festivals like fringe festivals, or find a theater space and invite people. Or you could really perform the show anywhere. I performed in people's houses and things like that. And just understand that your very first shows probably aren't going to be your best shows, and allow yourself to get better at it.
This is the end of task one. Now turn to task two. Task two. Listen to a talk about dreaming. For questions 1 to 9, choose the best options A, B, or C. Write your answers in the table provided. Question 0 is an example. Now you have 2 minutes to read the task.
In the 3rd millennium BCE, Mesopotamian kings recorded and interpreted their dreams on wax tablets. 1,000 years later, ancient Egyptians wrote a dream book listing over 100 common dreams and their meanings. And in the years since, we haven't paused in our quest to understand why we dream. So, after a great deal of scientific research, technological advancement, and persistence, we still don't have any definite answers. But we have some interesting theories. We dream to fulfill our wishes. In the early 1900s, Sigmund Freud proposed that while all of our dreams, including our nightmares, are a collection of images from our daily conscious lives, they also have symbolic meanings, which relate to the fulfillment of our subconscious wishes. Freud theorized that everything we remember when we wake up from a dream is a symbolic representation of our unconscious primitive thoughts, urges, and desires. Freud believed that by analyzing those remembered elements, the unconscious content would be revealed to our conscious mind, and psychological issues stemming from its repression could be addressed and resolved. To increase performance on certain mental tasks, sleep is good, but dreaming while sleeping is better. In 2010, researchers found that subjects were much better at getting through a complex 3D maze if they had napped and dreamed of the maze prior to their second attempt. In fact, they were up to 10 times better at it than those who only thought of the maze while awake between attempts,
and those who napped but did not dream about the maze. Researchers theorize that certain memory processes can happen only when we are asleep, and our dreams are a signal that these processes are taking place. There are about 10,000 trillion neural connections within the architecture of your brain. They are created by everything you think and everything you do. A 1983 neurobiological theory of dreaming called reverse learning holds that while sleeping, and mainly during REM sleep cycles, your neocortex reviews these neural connections and dumps the unnecessary ones. Without this unlearning process, which results in your dreams, your brain could be overrun by useless connections, and parasitic thoughts could disrupt the necessary thinking you need to do while you're awake. The continual activation theory proposes that your dreams result from your brain's need to constantly consolidate and create long-term memories in order to function properly. So when external input falls below a certain level, like when you're asleep, your brain automatically triggers the generation of data from its memory storages, which appear to you in the form of the thoughts and feelings you experience in your dreams. In other words, your dreams might be a random screensaver your brain turns on so it doesn't completely shut down. Dreams involving dangerous and threatening situations are very common, and the primitive instinct rehearsal theory holds that the content of a dream is significant to its purpose. Whether it's an anxiety-filled night of being chased through the woods by a bear or fighting off a ninja in a dark alley, these dreams allow you to practice your fight or flight instincts and keep them sharp and dependable, in case you'll need them in real life. But it doesn't always have to be unpleasant. For instance, dreams about your attractive neighbor could actually give your reproductive instinct some practice too. Stress neurotransmitters in the brain are much less active during the REM stage of sleep, even during dreams of traumatic experiences, leading some researchers to theorize that one purpose of dreaming is to take the edge off painful experiences to allow for psychological healing. Reviewing traumatic events in your dreams with less mental stress may grant you a clearer perspective and an enhanced ability to process them in psychologically healthy ways. People with certain mood disorders and PTSD often have difficulty sleeping, leading some scientists to believe that lack of dreaming may be a contributing factor to their illnesses. Unconstrained by reality and the rules of conventional logic, in your dreams, your mind can create limitless scenarios to help you grasp problems and formulate solutions that you may not consider while awake. John Steinbeck called it the Committee of Sleep, and research has demonstrated the effectiveness of dreaming on problem solving. It's also how renowned chemist Auguste Kekulé discovered the structure of the benzene molecule, and it's the reason that sometimes the best solution for a problem is to sleep on it. And those are just a few of the more prominent theories. As technology increases our capability for understanding the brain, it's possible that one day we will discover the definitive reason for them. But until that time arrives, we'll just have to keep on dreaming.
Listen again.
In the 3rd millennium BCE, Mesopotamian kings recorded and interpreted their dreams on wax tablets. 1,000 years later, ancient Egyptians wrote a dream book listing over 100 common dreams and their meanings. And in the years since, we haven't paused in our quest to understand why we dream. So, after a great deal of scientific research, technological advancement, and persistence, we still don't have any definite answers. But we have some interesting theories. We dream to fulfill our wishes. In the early 1900s, Sigmund Freud proposed that while all of our dreams, including our nightmares, are a collection of images from our daily conscious lives, they also have symbolic meanings, which relate to the fulfillment of our subconscious wishes. Freud theorized that everything we remember when we wake up from a dream is a symbolic representation of our unconscious primitive thoughts, urges, and desires. Freud believed that by analyzing those remembered elements, the unconscious content would be revealed to our conscious mind, and psychological issues stemming from its repression could be addressed and resolved. To To increase performance on certain mental tasks, sleep is good, but dreaming while sleeping is better. In 2010, researchers found that subjects were much better at getting through a complex 3D maze if they had napped and dreamed of the maze prior to their second attempt. In fact, they were up to 10 times better at it than those who only thought of the maze while awake between attempts, and those who napped but did not dream about the maze. Researchers theorize that certain memory processes can happen only when we are asleep, and our dreams are a signal that these processes are taking place. There are about 10,000 trillion neural connections within the architecture of your brain. They are created by everything you think and everything you do. A 1983 neurobiological theory of dreaming called reverse learning holds that while sleeping, and mainly during REM sleep cycles, your neocortex reviews these neural connections and dumps the unnecessary ones. Without this unlearning process, which results in your dreams, your brain could be overrun by useless connections, and parasitic thoughts could disrupt the necessary thinking you need to do while you're awake. The continual activation theory proposes that your dreams result from your brain's need to constantly consolidate and create long-term memories in order to function properly. So when external input falls below a certain level, like when you're asleep, your brain automatically triggers the generation of data from its memory storages, which appear to you in the form of the thoughts and feelings you experience in your dreams. In other words, your dreams might be a random screensaver your brain turns on so it doesn't completely shut down. Dreams involving dangerous and threatening situations are very common, and the primitive instinct rehearsal theory holds that the content of a dream is significant to its purpose. Whether it's an anxiety-filled night of being chased through the woods by a bear, or fighting off a ninja in a dark alley, these dreams allow you to practice your fight or flight instincts and keep them sharp and dependable in case you'll need them in real life. But it doesn't always have to be unpleasant. For instance, dreams about your attractive neighbor could actually give your reproductive instinct some practice too. Stress neurotransmitters in the brain are much less active during the REM stage of sleep, even during dreams of traumatic experiences, leading some researchers to theorize that one purpose of dreaming is to take the edge off painful experiences to allow for psychological healing. Reviewing traumatic events in your dreams with less mental stress may grant you a clearer perspective and an enhanced ability to process them in psychologically healthy ways. People with certain mood disorders and PTSD often have difficulty sleeping, leading some scientists to believe that lack of dreaming may be a contributing factor to their illnesses. Unconstrained by reality and the rules of conventional logic, in your dreams, your mind can create limitless scenarios to help you grasp problems and formulate solutions that you may not consider while awake. John Steinbeck called it the Committee of Sleep, and research has demonstrated the effectiveness of dreaming on problem solving. It's also how renowned chemist Auguste Kekulé discovered the structure of the benzene molecule, and it's the reason that sometimes the best solution for a problem is to sleep on it. And those are just a few of the more prominent theories. As technology increases our capability for understanding the brain, it's possible that one day we will discover the definitive reason for them. But until that time arrives, we'll just have to keep on dreaming.
This is the end of task 2. Now turn to task 3. Task 3. Listen to an interview with impersonator James Adomian. Decide if the sentences 1 to 10 are true or false according to the interview. Write your answers T, true, or F, false, in the table provided. Sentence 0 is an example. Now you have 1 minute and 30 seconds to read the task.
Joining me now is a comedian and actor known for his impressions of Bernie Sanders and George W. Bush. His credits include Harley Quinn, American Dad, BoJack Horseman, amongst many others. James Adomian, my dear old pal.
Oh, man, this is awesome. This is awesome. It's been too long.
Well, I did see you fairly recently.
Yeah.
And I can't remember where that was.
It was probably at the Greek theater taping.
Ah, that's where it was. And that's what triggered my brain. And I was like, I should have James on my podcast. And before I saw you at that taping, it had been quite a few years since I had seen you.
Yeah, I ran into you in the Larchmont area.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of a very healthy restaurant.
Yes.
Cafe Gratitude.
Yes, Cafe Gratitude. I frequent plant-based restaurants. Are you vegan? You're not vegan.
I'm not vegan, but I play one on TV. I mean, I'm not afraid of eating a vegan meal at a restaurant sometimes. And I love Cafe Gratitude, how they have the positivity propaganda in all the names of everything.
Yes. Is that what you were there for?
I'm there mostly because I'm down and I need to be picked up by the names of the dishes. So you're like, instead of ordering like a burrito, you're like, I am resplendent.
Yes, you have to say that.
And I'll have a side of I am worthy.
Mm-hmm. What is this, a commercial for Cafe Gratitude? Ultimately, right?
I would love it if there was some really angry guy there who was like, I've been waiting on my I am grateful for over 30 minutes.
There probably has been. I remember when they first opened, some guy from the back that didn't understand the silliness around delivering food. Because they bring the food to your table and they say, you are magical, and then hand you your order that is named that. Mm-hmm. And this guy from the back came out and it was a table next to us. And he just said, you are a burrito. And then he ran off and went back into the kitchen. It was pretty incredible.
That's a high compliment, actually.
To be called a burrito?
Yes.
Well, my friend, the burrito, IndieWire called you the podcast world's man of 1,000 voices. You've impersonated a huge range of people, from Gary Busey to Marc Maron, which, by the way, I would love to hear your Marc Maron.
Yeah, man, I'm done. I got nothing. What do you want? What do you want? Don't ask Mark.
Have you been on Mark's show?
Yeah, a long time, like 10 years ago I was on. Uh-huh. I was pretty young.
Has he heard the impersonation?
Oh, yeah. One time back in the old days at UCB, we were at a show and, you know, I had been like making fun of him before he got there in the green room. And then I'm like, I left the room and come back and Mark's there. Uh-huh. He just says, I heard you do an impression of me. Do it on stage tonight. I want to see it.
Did he like it?
Yes. Uh-huh. Mark Maron is the first and only time that someone I did an impression of has given me like notes. Usually it's either like, hey, wow, you got me, or like, how dare you? There was nothing like me. But Mark Maron was like, yeah, that was funny. That was funny. You said something. What was that thing you said? You said something about a stool. And I was like, yeah, I said, I'm a brain suffering on a stool. And he goes, see, that's not exactly it. I'm not just sitting there suffering. I'm also giving back. He was like coaching me on how to do an American impression the right way.
That's great. Who is your favorite? Who do you enjoy most to mimic?
It shifts over time with whatever's happening, you know, in the world and the news. But right now I'm doing Mike Lindell a lot, the MyPillow guy.
Oh.
I'd play him on Jimmy Kimmel.
How is it that that's world events? What's going on in the world?
It's me, Mike Lindell from MyPillow, your trusted source of information about election and our democracy. Democracy is like a fine pillow. It's full of stuff you never see and you don't want it to pop open.
Have you met him? I would love to hear his notes.
I did meet him.
How do you meet him?
Well, he was on Jimmy Kimmel at the same time I was.
Ah, okay, there you go.
I was like prepared for him to be difficult or hostile or something. But he was like a little boy that had gone to Disneyland for the first time. He was like, oh, gosh, wow, you sure got me. Whoa, wow.
I remember you did an impression of me years ago. You'd put your foot up on like the edge of a chair and like lean over like, yeah.
Is that where we are? You guys think that's enough of a reaction? It's also same as the Todd Berry impression, but meaner.
That's right.
That's how you do Tig Notaro.
I'm meaner than Todd.
I mean, that's the persona.
Yeah. Well, I have notes for you, just so you know.
Thank you. Ironically, it involves a stool as well.
Yeah, when I see you again in the next, I don't know.
We're on a 2-year schedule.
Yeah, if not more. Now, you found a lot of success, James, in your impressions of politicians. And obviously, you're a comedian. So are you a political comedian?
I would hate to be called that because that's kind of like a way of advertising that you're not funny. I'm a political comedian. Come see how I roast both sides. My nightly show here in the back of a restaurant. I mean, I just kind of can't avoid it because they're like very famous people that everyone knows who they are. So that's kind of what you want if you're doing an impression of somebody.
Right. And do you just naturally follow politics or are you doing it for the material?
I used to more than I do now. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, I would say it's just politics won't leave me alone. You try not to pay attention. And then it's just like, you have to.
What is the impression you have worked so hard on and you can't quite nail it and it drives you insane and you wish you could?
That's a good question. That's a tough one because I've burned those notes. I don't know. I guess I feel like sometimes if somebody has done something a lot before I got to the table, maybe a TV show or a cartoon will try to get me to do something. And sometimes I will if it's like if I'm hired on a cartoon or something and they're like, do an Al Pacino impression. But I really don't. It's not where I need to be, you know?
Yeah.
Gucci. Gucci. Yeah. You like, do you need to see that?
Listen again.
Joining me now is a comedian and actor known for his impressions of Bernie Sanders and George W. Bush. His credits include Harley Quinn, American Dad, BoJack Horseman, amongst many others. James Adomian, my dear old pal.
Oh, man, this is awesome. This is awesome. It's been too long.
Well, I did see you fairly recently.
Yeah.
And I can't remember where that was.
It was probably at the Greek theater taping.
Ah, that's where it was. And that's what triggered my brain. And I was like, ah, I should have James on my podcast. And before I saw you at that taping, it had been quite a few years since I had seen you.
Yeah, I ran into you in the Larchmont area.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of a very healthy restaurant.
Yes.
Cafe Gratitude.
Yes, Cafe Gratitude. I frequent plant-based restaurants. Are you vegan? You're not vegan.
I'm not vegan, but I play one on TV. I mean, I'm not afraid of eating a vegan meal at a restaurant sometimes. And I love Cafe Gratitude, how they have the positivity propaganda in all the names of everything.
Yes. Is that what you were there for?
I'm there mostly because I'm down and I need to be picked up by the names of the dishes. So you're like, instead of ordering like a burrito, you're like, I am resplendent.
Yes, you have to say that.
And I'll have a side of I am worthy.
Mm-hmm. What is this, a commercial for Cafe Gratitude? Ultimately, right?
I would love it if there was some really angry guy there who was like, I've been waiting on my I am grateful for over 30 minutes.
There probably has been. I remember when they first opened, some guy from the back that didn't understand the silliness around delivering food, because they bring the food to your table and they say, you are magical, and then hand you your order that is named that. And this guy from the back came out and it was a table next to us. And he just said, you are a burrito. And then he ran off and went back into the kitchen. It was pretty incredible.
That's a high compliment.
To be called a burrito.
Yes.
Well, my friend, the burrito, IndieWire called you the podcast world's man of 1,000 voices. You've impersonated a huge range of people, from Gary Busey to Marc Maron, which, by the way, I would love to hear your Marc Maron.
Yeah, man, I'm done. I got nothing. What do you want? What do you want? Don't ask Mark.
Have you been on Mark's show?
Yeah, a long time, like 10 years ago I was on.
Uh-huh.
I was pretty young.
Has he heard the impersonation?
Oh, yeah. One time back in the old days at UCB, we were at a show and, you know, I had been like making fun of him before he got there in the green room. And then I'm like, I left the room and come back and Mark's there.
Uh-huh.
He just says, I heard you do an impression of me. Do it on stage tonight. I want to see it.
Did he like it?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Marc Maron is the first and only time that someone I did an impression of has given me like notes. Usually it's either like, hey, wow, you got me, or like, how dare you? There was nothing like me. But Marc Maron was like, yeah, that was funny. That was funny. You said something. What was that thing you said? You said something about a stool. And I was like, yeah, I said, I'm a brain suffering on a stool. And he goes, see, that's not exactly it. I'm not just sitting there suffering. I'm also giving back. He was like coaching me on how to do an American impression the right way.
That's great. Who is your favorite? Who do you enjoy most to mimic?
It shifts over time with whatever's happening, you know, in the world and the news. But right now I'm doing Mike Lindell a lot, the MyPillow guy.
Oh.
I'd play him on Jimmy Kimmel.
How is it that that's world events? What's going on in the world?
It's me, Mike Lindell, from MyPillow, your trusted source of information about election and our democracy. Democracy is like a fine pillow. It's full of stuff you never see, and you don't want it to pop open.
Have you met him? I would love to hear his notes.
I did meet him.
How do you meet him?
Well, he was on Jimmy Kimmel at the same time I was.
Ah, okay, there you go.
I was, like, prepared for him to be difficult or hostile or something. But he was like a little boy that had gone to Disneyland for the first time. He was like, oh, gosh, wow, you sure got me. Whoa, wow.
I remember you did an impression of me years ago. You'd put your foot up on like the edge of a chair and like lean over like, yeah.
Is that where we are? You guys think that's enough of a reaction? It's also same as the Todd Berry impression, but meaner.
That's right.
That's how you do Tig Notaro.
I'm meaner than Todd.
I mean, that's the persona.
Yeah. Well, I have notes for you, just so you know.
Thank you. Ironically, it involves a stool as well.
Yeah, when I see you again in the next, I don't know.
We're on a 2-year schedule.
Yeah, if not more. Now, you found a lot of success, James, in your impressions of politicians. And obviously, you're a comedian. So are you a political comedian?
I would hate to be called that because that's kind of like a way of advertising that you're not funny. I'm a political comedian. See, come see how I roast both sides. My nightly show here in the back of a restaurant. I mean, I just kind of can't avoid it because they're like very famous people that everyone knows who they are. So it's kind of what you want if you're doing an impression of somebody.
Right. And do you just naturally follow politics? Or are you doing it for the material?
I used to more than I do now. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, I would say it's just politics won't leave me alone. You try not to pay attention. And then it's just like, you have to.
What is the impression you have worked so hard on and you can't quite nail it and it drives you insane and you wish you could?
That's a good question. That's a tough one because I've burned those notes. I don't know. I guess I feel like sometimes if somebody has done something a lot before I got to the table, maybe a TV show or a cartoon will try to get me to do something. And sometimes I will if I'm hired on a cartoon or something and they're like, do an Al Pacino impression. But I really don't. It's not where I need to be, you know?
Yeah.
Gucci! Gucci, yeah! You like, do you need to see that?
This is the end of Task 3 and the end of the listening test.